who is the editorial projects director for the Foundation Deep Ecology. And he's also the president of the New England Wilderness Trust. He's the author of Wildlands and Philanthropy and co-editor of Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth, Plundering Appalachia, the Tragedy of Mountaintop Removal Mining and Coal Mining, and Keeping the Wild Against the Domestication of the Earth. Tom will be talking today about how our language reinforces the worldview of dominion over the earth, such as we were starting to hear about with Eileen's talk just now. So thank you very much and welcome, Tom.
Every day, the earth grew poorer. transformed bit by bit by Lord Mann's numbers and actions. The seas were emptied of fish and filled with garbage. The trees were replaced by bleeding stumps. The prairies were transformed into feeding factories for the ever-expanding human masses. Smokestacks darkened the skies. No place was safe. No landscape safe from the insatiable creature's thirst for more energy to serve his god of growth. Lord Mann tamed rivers, split atoms, decapitated mountains, and stabbed the earth everywhere he thought a vein of fuel lay hidden. When the feverish earth cried out, sending furies to communicate her distress, Lord Mann denied her sickness until it no longer could be denied. Slowly, the scales began to fall from his eyes when he saw famine ravage the land, when he saw precious sources of fresh water disappear, when the longing that gnawed on his spirit made him recall so many creatures that had passed into oblivion. Seeing the effects of his hubris, he began to wonder if his empire was secure. His delusion weakened just enough to reveal the choice before him. Two paths. One, leading to an abundant earth filled with birdsong. The other, the way of growth, offered riches for some, misery for many, and ultimate destruction for all his tribe. Would he restrain his numbers and rejoin the community of life as plain member and citizen? Or attempt to engineer all the earth to his will, heeding only the call of more? The call of more. So that's my shorthand of how we got to this moment into the so-called age of human dominion. And now we're enveloped in the technosphere, this world of human created artifacts and techniques, a hyper complex interconnected system of exploitative processes running on this one time windfall of cheap fossil energy. But as normal as this may seem to us in a place like this, in a grand city like this, in this particular moment, it is of course a very, very new phenomenon in human history. For the vast, vast majority of our history as a species, humans were embedded not in the technosphere, but in the biosphere, embedded in the fabric of life that conceived us. We had emerged from this boundless creativity of wild nature that also birthed the trilobites, and then later the dinosaurs, and then much later other large mammals like us, the grizzlies and the gorillas. And if this is our deepest human experience, if this is our fundamental history, to be members of the biotic community, and not self-appointed overseers of the planetary plantation, then how did we go so wrong? Now, that is beyond the scope of our time here to dig into too deeply into the causes of humanity's break from nature. But it's really fun around the campfire conversation, the conversation I actually had around the campfire last week with some of the folks in the hall today, to think about how we got to this place. What were those root drivers? Was it the invention of capitalism, or was it really the invention of agriculture that got us on the wrong path? Or going way back, was it the invention of language that allowed early humans to hunt cooperatively, to begin to kill other large mammals and have that break from primal unity? That's fun to think about. I really like to have that conversation around the campfire, but it's beyond our scope to delve into today. What we can say is that language, which we should note is also a very recent invention, a relatively recent invention in human history, language is powerful. Language powerfully shapes the way we see the world. Language is the foundation of this industrial worldview that we're discussing this weekend, that worldview that seeks to commodify every part of nature's richness and bounty, to bend the earth to our will, to garden it for our purposes. The lexicon of techno-industrial growth culture supports that process of assimilation. Now, it's common sense, of course, to understand that our linguistic patterns shape our cognitive frames. And there are, you know, genuine bona fide scholars on this panel and others to come who are better suited to dissect this. But as a simple-minded sort, as a non-academic, a simple lover of wilderness and wildlife, that is, wilderness self-willed lands, not bent or yoked to human will, and self-willed creatures who call those places home. And as a practicing on-the-ground conservationist with the Northeast Wilderness Trust, I can tell you, it drives me nuts. It drives me crazy to hear how so many colleagues and friends in our own community in the conservation and environmental movements have so unthinkingly adopted the language of resources, of possession of the earth. Now, we expect to hear the language of dominion from the enemies of nature, from the PR flags of the corporations, from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, from the ad agencies who are the hired guns for every destructive form of technology. It's no surprise when the manufacturer of an all-terrain vehicle tells us, don't just hit the trail, pound it mercilessly. And that's real ad copy, which, not incidentally, is actually really quite good. It's very picky ad copy. It's morally repugnant, but it's good. But that doesn't bother me so much as it does to hear how our own community speaks of humanity's relationship to the earth. So how about this ad from the Nature Conservancy recently in Time magazine, right there by the pharmaceutical ads, which hopefully informs us that nature cleans our air. Well, isn't that really nice of Mother Nature, you know, here framed for us as a sort of planetary cleaning lady, cleaning up after those messy humans, tidying up our air, our air, know that possessive, you know that air belongs to us. This is just one of a series of ads that the Nature Conservancy has been running to communicate the so-called array of ecosystem services that nature provides to humanity. Now, it's true, certainly, that humanity depends utterly upon nature's diversity and ecological functioning. Promoting conservation as primarily not about preventing extinction, human-caused extinction, but primarily about sustaining ecosystem services, is this fundamentally anthropocentric frame. It's implicit in those in the term even. It's those ecosystems out there serve us. Or consider this example here, of the kind of language that everybody in the hall would have seen from either an environmental group or a greenwashing corporation. Our environment's precious. Good stewardship of natural resources is key to sustaining a healthy working landscape. So let's unpack this one a bit. Okay, here we have the possessive again. You know, the world is ours. It's not the community of life to which we belong, but it's the backdrop to human history. It's just the stuff around us, the environment. But even used as that sort of shorthand moniker for the totality of organic and inorganic elements of the ecosphere, the environment, like the economy, is an abstraction. It helps distance us from reality, from caring about real places, real forests or wetlands or grasslands, the home to real creatures that are being destroyed by the expanding technosphere. The environment, of course, in this kind of framing, is just a collection of natural resources that we are free to exploit, perhaps gently, if we want to use good stewardship. So the phrase natural resources, or natural resources, of course, commodifies the living earth, again, in an anthropocentric frame. And as for stewardship, which is a perfectly awful word, look up the etymology. Look it up. The steward comes from the stai word, the word of the sty, the ward of the hogs, out behind the thatch-covered hovel. So stewardship, whether practiced either kindly or rapaciously, means domestication and management. And domestication also is implicit and framed positively in this working landscape phrase, which of course trickled down from industrial forest clearcutters who started celebrating the so-called working forest, and now is widely used by people who should know better and who think of themselves as environmentalists. So to confront anthropocentrism, this worldview of supposed human exceptionalism that makes humanity's thoughtless appropriation or even enslavement of the world seem perfectly natural and normal to us, we must confront also the language of dominion, and that begins at home with all of us. So I would challenge you to keep a watchful eye out for these and other pernicious terms that support a resourcist relationship to the earth, and which convey that managerial mindset. And once you start looking for them, I guarantee you will see them everywhere. Look for them, highlight them, note them, and renounce them. Renounce them. Let all of us who imagine a future world of beauty and diversity, begin to use a rhetoric of reciprocity, the language of love, when speaking of the wild earth, not an environment, not a garden to be managed, but a wild community of life, a living membership, our one and only home.